Hey, this is Frank, author of the Host Deep Dive book, and you're listening to my buddy Speed and John on the Virtual Speaking Podcast.
Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're going to learn today.
Innovate like a startup, deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's going to be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 5050. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Aero, and joining me as always is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, sir?
I'm excited.
I feel like I'm talking to the past version of John because this is a pre-recorded episode because John's somewhere in the exotic world of Bali or somewhere else right now. So I'm speaking to the past version. Why don't you present the future version? John, how's your vacation?
It's great, man. I got a little bit of a sunburn, you know, but I'm sitting here on the beach reading some technical documentation on my Kindle, enjoying a fruity drink. So, you know,
nice. I like
life
it.
Life is good.
Scuba diving went well, I'm sure. You're still alive.
Yep. No losing the GoPro this time.
Nice. Well, John, this is our 50th episode. I can't believe we've already gotten to episode 50. It's been a lot of fun. And this week is no exception because we've got an awesome topic. John, you've been telling me lately about this concept of vSAN off-road, and I want you to tell me all about that. But before we do, why don't we bring on our guest so he can join the conversation? This week from VMware, we're bringing on SE manager James Lafort. James, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here on the golden anniversary edition of the podcast.
Exactly. You should feel very special. This is our 50th.
It's all gold, baby.
It's all gold indeed. All right, John, tell us, what exactly is this concept of vSAN off-road?
So I keep getting occasionally these questions where people are talking about some vSAN situation, and it requires a very unique configuration that's different maybe from a standard ready node, or it's not lined up with a beautiful, you know, appliance model or ready. Even it requires some heavy tweaking to a ready node if that'll even work. But it's still a valid use case. It's still something vSAN should be able to address. We're not shoving a round peg in a square hole here. And this term going off-road kind of refers to designs from my years in the VAR space, to where we would build these solutions where, you know, it was kind of, you're like, at first you tilt your head and you're like, wait, you did what? And then you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, getting these custom fiber channel to PCIe adapters so I could provide LUNs to some Mac hosts to do a Mac virtualization cluster, you know, is a case of going off road. Is that something there's a reference architecture anyone normal does? No, but it was a video game design shop. They needed virtualization of Macs. They needed to run Mac instances. And so did it work? Yeah. So this is kind of in that vein.
Yeah, and that sounds almost kind of scary to me. I get it. Don't get me wrong. I mean, but I do think, devil's advocate here, that there is a reason why, you know, infrastructure started with this whole converged infrastructure idea where these prescribed solutions came out. Because when it comes time to support, you want to be able to say, hey, well, this is how I have it configured. You guys told me to do it this way, and it's not working. So I kind of get the idea for these prescribed solutions, and I get the idea, but the simplicity of 8CI. Isn't this potentially going down a road of causing more pain for our customers to throw out these ideas? Hey, just do whatever you want with these things. I'm just playing devil's advocate. What do you think about that?
Well, and the phrase, particularly if you ever listen to Chad talk about, you know, why converged infrastructure came around, is you'll always hear the phrase, you need to de-risk things. And part of that is do things that are, you know, assumed. It does let you move faster. You can go off-road, and there are risks, and you need to be aware of them. And you need to go slower when you go off road. You know, I can drive, you know, my rental car 100 miles an hour on the you know, paved road. When I go off road, I got to slow it down. I really can't go over maybe 30. What I love about rental cars is they're all off road. Greatest off road vehicles ever. Now, whether you get back on, that's another matter. But the situation here is you do need to go slower. You do need to go to the, you know, and I always advise customers if they're kind of going off road, you know, particularly with something like vSAN, talk to the SEs, talk to the architects. There's, you know, a dedicated team for that. They're brilliant. These guys have seen everything, and they know the right people to ask questions of. And if you're going to a case where something actually is explicitly not supported, or maybe it's not supported yet, there is a process called an RPQ that they can actually file and talk to PM and say, is there a reason this isn't supported? Maybe we just need engineering to test it. And so there's kind of a, as you go off road, the farther you go off road, the slower that process becomes. And a lot of people want to move quick. So there's definitely a lot of value still to, you know, coloring inside the lines, staying inside the box, so to speak.
All right, I'll buy that. Well, good for us. We actually have an SE on the call. So James, I'm interested in your opinion on this. Is this something that happens frequently? Do a lot of your customers come to you and say, hey, I have need X, which kind of deviates from the typical solution. Can you help me?
So it happens more often than you think. The customers will always ask, I love the solution. I like the best practices. Could I go and do something a little bit wonky or wacky? That's where the SE kind of joins in and says, you could, and to John's point, there's a process for that, but working closely with the SEs and either through a POC or through some valid demos, we can usually get the customer to come around to de-risk. And most of the time, that de-risk process comes back to following best practices and standards.
Okay, so it's a deviation, but we're still following some form of best practices and certainly not breaking any of the core rules of the product.
Correct. One of the biggest questions that some customers ask me is like, okay, what's going to happen in the future when I scale? Because if you look at most of the vSAN documentation, vSAN balance across the storage cluster is always a best practice, right? So if I'm going to standardize and the customer says they want to standardize on 1.2 terabyte drives on the capacity store, that's great. They'll go to their OEM of choice and they'll purchase today at day zero, 1.2 terabytes. Being the scalability is a big value prop for the vSAN data store, I can't control, nor can the customer, what's going to happen with the storage vendors, hardware vendors over the next 2-3 years before that cluster node goes into a depreciation mode or becomes obsolete.
Right, right.
Right. So what if Toshiba or another storage vendor launches a 2.4 terabyte drive and the customer wants to scale? So in that case, my advice as an SE to the customer is going to be like, great, as long as you're maintaining the same drive characteristic from a performance perspective, whether you do 1.2 in 2 years, you do 2.4 terabyte drives, and then beyond, based on the value of vSAN, we're just going to aggregate and expose the overall capacity, right? So capacities at that point doesn't really matter if they're balanced or not. Where things get really, really important is you need to maintain the same performance characteristic such that you don't want to mix and match, for example, a TLC SSD with an NVMe device on your capacity tier, wonky things will happen. And those are some of the guidelines with questions coming from the customer, because they're all looking at the future trends and what's coming down the highway with respect to storage devices. But we usually have to rein them in and say, this is what's best. This is what will work. You can deviate, but don't go too far off into outer space.
A key thing to remember here is this isn't a new problem. I mean, I remember having a Clarion CX3 or something back in the day, and we had 73 gigabyte 15K drives, and I had one die, and the thing was pretty darn old at that point. And, you know, the service guy magically automatically shows up to swap it, and he puts 147 gig drive in because there are no more 73 gig drives. They just, no one's made them in years at this point.
Right.
So this is maintaining the same performance characteristics or better. This is something that's been around for drive swaps for a long time.
Makes sense to me. Well, what about, you know, I get it. So you want to have a minimum. You can certainly expand on capacity, keeping the same performance characteristics of the drives. But what about host configurations? Do you do the same with hosts, the actual hosts themselves?
So this is a fun question. So I have seen one case. I had a customer that they were asking if they could mix OEMs. If they could have two different server vendors in the same cluster. And the answer is yes. Now, I normally wouldn't do this for a couple of reasons. One, you typically manage lifecycle holistically on a cluster. People like to use that, you know, UCS Director or Dell Open Manage or things like that to manage that cluster. And so you're going to increase your operational costs and complexity of lifecycle management. But I have seen cases where customers would validate both and swap both, as well as also if you were adding clusters, you know, or adding hosts as part of a swap tree or depreciating out one server vendor on their older gen and moving a new one in. That does work. It's just you need to be aware of the life cycle and complexity and make sure, you know, your firmwares and everything are proper. Now, James, have you seen cases where there's questions around storage dense nodes or compute only nodes?
I'm seeing more questions these days around getting a storage dense node. The compute only node conversation tends to happen less and less as the market and the customer base is adopting HCI as a viable technology these days. But I still get the question at least once or twice a week, well, could I have some hosts that are going to be lighter on storage and some that are heavier on storage? And it's a valid config. But again, as the SE, our guidance is always, if you're going to have a host that is very storage dense compared to some of the others, you just need to make absolutely sure such that if that host goes into maintenance mode or worst case has an outage, that you have the available storage across the rest of the cluster to host what was on that failed host. So storage dense nodes tend to make sense, but there's just always that guided hand approach to make sure that the engineering and the configuration is supported, given that you kind of have an unbalanced config.
I mean, this is actually very similar sizing. If you look back at, I think it was Duncan and Frank's book, the DRS book had a lot of information on this about asymmetric memory configurations and making sure your VMs could fail over. You know, if you have one host with a terabyte of RAM and you had a bunch of hosts with 100 gigabytes of RAM, it's going to take a lot of those 100 gig hosts to be able to absorb the capacity of that host with a terabyte of RAM failing. Same thing with storage here. We want to make sure we can reprotect. And so having really asymmetric designs in that would be more a case if you were going to do this to where, you know, if you had four hosts that had 10 terabytes and you were going to add some hosts with 20, you might want to add four or something, have them as a group, so to speak, that add. That way there's probably enough capacity within that subset to handle that.
Yeah, this is an old problem, even for like stretch clusters. I mean, if you're configuring a hardware stretch cluster, you know, with storage arrays, same thing, right? There's been guidance around that saying, make sure that both of your sites have, you know, a similar size or capacity. So if you're going to be failing over X amount of VMs from site A to site B, that there's going to be enough resources and enough storage to support that failover. So this is certainly a problem that we've seen over the years, but certainly also applies to HCI.
And another thing to think about is not just capacity, it's also performance. You got the compute side to worry about. You also have just this general storage performance. I've seen cases where a customer had a generation 3 of a certain storage array historically with a stretch cluster, and then they had old generation 2 at the DR site that had a quarter of the cache, and it had, you know, very small amount of flash. It was mostly slow drives, and they went to do an SRM failover test, and it took, you know, a day to boot everything up. So I've said this a million times, but your boot storm is your worst IO load that you're ever going to take. It's not your steady state operations. It's trying to reboot, you know, 400 or 500 VMs at the same time. That hits storage pretty hard. So that is something to consider. Now, you mentioned stretch clusters. I am getting, particularly now with nested fault domains, I am getting some questions about asymmetric vSAN stretch cluster design. Have you seen any of this, James? You know, having two nodes on one side and five on the other or something like that?
The question tends to come up. Full disclosure, stretch cluster is more prevalent in the EMEA markets for me. But now that we do have the nested fault domain or local data protection feature, the question's coming up more and more.
Again, this is something where best practices, read the stretch cluster guide. Let's try to keep them consistent on both sides. The case where you would do asymmetric was if you only had a couple VMs that you wanted to stretch. Remember, vSAN stretch clustering, you can, with SPVM, say, you know, secondary failure protection. These VMs, I don't want to stretch them. They could just have local RAID 1, RAID 5 policies, but I had a small amount that I wanted to stretch. You might have an asymmetric config. The risk you need to be aware of is monitoring capacity of that secondary. Monitoring capacity gets kind of wonky because now you're not just looking holistically at the cluster because things aren't perfectly balanced in terms of capacity. You now have separate capacity items. And the default just general cluster level view of capacity is not going to warn you that you're running out of disk space on the other side. Now, there are some disk group alarms. And there are some RVC and I think even some dashboards possibly with VROPs, and maybe this stuff may get better. We'll see. That'll let you look at a disk group level, but you would actually need to be monitoring hosts for capacity. And before you design this, you'd really want to sit down, do the math and figure out how much data can I stretch? And then, you know, how much data, if I don't stretch, can I capacity? And kind of there's a little bit more pencil and paper math there than most people would probably want to do.
Yeah, John, I would almost imagine that a lot of the folks that are listening may be coming from a storage background where when you're doing any type of, whether it's Metro cluster or any other type of stretch cluster solution, it's hardwired in your brain that these need to be exactly the same on each side. We should probably have Jace come in and do a full explanation of the whole stretch cluster and some of the benefits, but it would probably seem really weird for someone to have a stretch cluster solution where we had, say, two hosts on one side and five on the other, because it just wouldn't, it would seem almost like a waste. Like, how does that work? Because most people think that everything gets replicated. There is no option to choose. So we should probably maybe expound a little bit on how stretch clustering works with vSAN.
Yeah, that sounds like a good opportunity for another host deep dive there. So
yeah, absolutely. Jace, put it on your calendar, man. You're coming in to tell us all about the benefits of stretch cluster on vSAN.
I like that.
Yeah.
So here's an example that I had from another customer from a non-stretch environment, right? Back to that paradigm of production and VR has to be a like for like on storage capacity. Our customers are getting very creative based on the feature set of what they know vSAN can do. So I have a customer here in the Midwest, and they're doing, I believe it's an 8-node cluster in production, and they decide to do across all of their VMs, they're doing an FTT equals 2. So they're getting a lot of protection across that cluster for all of those VMDKs. Their DR side, or their cold side, is only going to be doing, instead of 8 nodes, like for like, they're doing a 4-node cluster. Using vSphere replication, they're taking those VMDKs and replicating them to the dark side. Now, it's not a balanced config, because guess what? When those VMDKs are going and being replicated, they're taking upon themselves the default storage policy. Customer said to me, well, couldn't I change that default storage policy FTT 0 on the cold side? Basically, how many condoms do I really need to protect my data? So they're doing FTT 2 in production, but on the cold side, they're doing FTT 0, which allows them to save on capacity and actually reduce that cluster footprint on the cold side. So they're getting really creative based on the features of what they know we can do to minimize their overall CapEx footprint on storage and availability.
Let's talk about FTT equals 0, because that's something that you would generally regard as, this is not a good practice to run stuff as RAID 0. That's been drilled into our brain forever. But tertiary copies, when you already have exceeding data protection at other sites, that's one good use case. Another one I've heard is actually test dev. If you've got stuff that's just ethereal, You provision it. If it blows up, you'll just provision another one. You really don't care. It's, you know, containers or something. You know, is it really worth the capacity of protecting it? Maybe, maybe not. You know, the one thing to be aware of with FTT 0, I've seen people do this with link clones. In fact, back in the 5.5 days, it used to be the default in Horizon. It's changed for good reason. Is be aware that if you do FTT 0 and a VM becomes unavailable, you now have an orphaned object. And you do have to go potentially clean, you have to run a script to clean that up. And the other thing is, if you've got a provisioning system that doesn't gracefully handle VMs just disappearing, I mean, we all talk about cattle, you know, cattle versus pets, but if your provisioning system isn't aware of, you know, oh, some cattle died, just move on. If your provisioning system will stop and start throwing errors and say, oh my gosh, what happened to this VM? Then that's something, you know, by default, Horizon Composer does that, although there is a flag to override that, say continue provisioning on error. That's something you need to be aware of when using FTT 0. Any other cases you see for FTT 0?
So, John, my customer base, they're tending to use or to label FTT 0 for what they're calling throwaway VMs, right? So to your point around test dev, the one I see a lot is file print, basically where it takes less time to rebuild the VM to get it back into production on a rebuild, manual rebuild, as opposed to having additional storage consumed for it to be an FTT 1 or better type scenario.
Now, one thing to note here is that, you know, people think, well, I've got a 12-node cluster with 12 disks. I've got 144 drives in my environment, and I have a failure on one host or something. I don't want to lose all my FTT zeros. What you have to realize is, by default, unless that VM is very large above 250, or those objects are very large above 255 gigabytes, or you've set a stripe policy, they're probably not going to end up on very many hosts, potentially as, you know, as few as 2 or 4, you know, based on whatever your RAID set is. And so even though you may lose some from a drive failure that are set to FTT 0, statistically, the larger the cluster gets, it's an exponentially smaller amount, a chance of any given failure impacting any given set within a group of FTT 0 VMs. So the larger the cluster, actually, the less obnoxious that should get.
Yep, that makes sense to me. So what are the, I know I was at a meeting the other day, and it was a customer roundtable, and there were a bunch of customers out there for vSAN, some that were just kind of exploring it. And I heard some of the customers, they were throwing the idea like, oh, I, you know, we're using it a lot for, you know, these two nodes plus a witness, you know, having all their witnesses in the data center, and then just having these two node clusters, you know, spread out all around. And one of the comments that came out was like, someone was like, oh yeah, that's like the perfect use case for vSAN, which I think that is a good use case. It is certainly not the only use case, but I'm curious, in the field, what are some of the use cases? How big are the clusters that you're seeing out there, or what is the most common cluster size that you see out there?
So great question. So the common cluster size tends to be, in my environment, between 8 and 12 hosts in a cluster. And that's just from a manageability perspective. I have some customers going 12 to 16, but even from the vSphere days, most vSphere admins don't want to manage a cluster that's greater than 32 nodes. So I tend to see 12 to 16 node clusters. They're getting quite common. To the comment on vSAN Robo, that is still a very popular use case, but it's nowhere near the only use case, right? It's a very niche customer segment. It tends to be retail, banking, healthcare with clinics, and so on. It just tends to be a very popular one because customers say, this is a great solution for what I used to have, let's say, in a retail store. But by far, vSAN Robo is definitely a niche market, whereas the traditional environment in the enterprise, the large enterprise, and even global accounts tends to be the 12, 16 node clusters for traditional data center workloads, business critical apps, and all of the above.
So from a cluster size, obviously, it's great that vSAN scales down for Robo, but often most of the conversations I have are with it scaling up. I wrote a blog on this actually called How Big My vSAN Cluster Be, and I love the Jurassic Park, you know, analogy, the Dr. Malcolm, his lunch speech of, did you ever stop and think just because you could, you know, if you should? And this applies generally to vSphere clusters. Yes, we have customers with 64, you know, host clusters. We have customers with over 2 petabytes raw on a cluster. The flip side, though, is do you want a management blast domain, so to speak, that is that large? Is there, what is the incremental benefit from an efficiency standpoint? You know, when you go from 3 hosts to 4, you go from having to keep 33% of resources for Slack for failure versus 25 and so forth. But that's an exponentially decreasing curve, the benefit of adding one more host to a cluster versus saying, all right, 14, 12, you know, that's good enough.
Yeah.
And this goes back to compute and memory. We've had the same conversations about, you know, how many resources do I save for my N+1 protection or N+2 protection by building a bigger cluster? Now, if you're at the situation to where you're, do I build 2 3-host clusters or a 6? It's a lot of benefits to that 6 because potentially now you could have, you know, more than one failure. So there is kind of a sweet spot. And that's something, again, a lot of the rules that, you know, Duncan and others have written extensively about for sizing compute apply here in this case. In one case I did want to loop back to was the case of compute-only nodes. And the use case I was talking with recently was a service provider where they had a lot of blades. They were sweating that asset down. They're under the vCAN pricing model. So the vSAN, they're not paying for sockets. They're paying for capacity. And they were looking at adding 6 nodes of balanced vSAN to a, you know, I think it was a 18 or 20 node blade CPU farm for vSAN. And this came up. And, you know, one, we discussed how vSAN is supported on blades. They're supported on HP blades. They're supported on Dell FX2, which is a blade-y platform. And then they're also supported on HP and Cisco UCS. Yep. But in this case, they wanted a little more capacity than the number of drive bays would align with. And so they were looking at doing this. So have you seen any configs like that, James?
I tend to be very conservative when recommending those types of configs. Again, to your example, John, is that from a sizing and engineering perspective, if I have 4 storage nodes and I add 16 compute nodes, running all those workloads, I could quickly overrun the I/O of my storage, right? So it tends to be more of a sizing exercise. Although always supported, we don't recommend going more compute to less storage, right? So in most of the customer environments that I've seen maybe 2 or 3 additional compute nodes, compute only nodes for that matter, to balance out a storage cluster. But I had one customer ask me, well, I have 2 storage hosts that are compute and storage, and I want to add 8 more compute only nodes because that's my workload. And that's just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, the concern point there I'd have is, you know what it's like to fail from a, you know, boot perspective and things like that and boot IO. Again, watch for those bootstorm IOs. And particularly if you have very few storage nodes, if you only have 3 or 4, you lose one node, you've now got rebuild IO. On top of that, you're now concentrating. So you've got a 33% amplification of IO just in general to the other hosts. And if you're doing erasure code, you know, you have a damaged stripe, you've got some read amplification. it's more during the failure. You'd want to test that failure. That would be part of the POC process. You'd really want to do is test what it's like with load gen with a failure and see how that handles.
Yep. Yeah, because I've definitely heard folks say early on, you know, about vSensing, oh, that's great, but every time I want to scale, what if I don't need more storage, but now I'm having to pay for it because I'm adding a whole nother node, which includes storage. But it's good to know that there are deviations, and you can, for the time when you do need that, you know, compute, you can do that. But obviously with the risk of not having another location for failover.
Well, and the one thing to look at that is if you're just wanting to grow that kind of storage more heavy node, that or not, you keep the same amount of storage, but you maybe go lighter on compute has been something that's been discussed. I've got a blog post on how to do a storage only node on vSAN. And generally that's more about licensing is what drives that of, I want to keep Oracle off of these sockets so Larry doesn't get another yacht. and you can enforce that with DRS rules. So that is one thing to note is, you know, I've seen cases where people will go single socket also for those added hosts that are really not there to provide much compute, but they're there to provide storage. And in those cases with the storage only nodes, you'd probably keep them balanced. You'd probably ideally just grow, but you might go, you know, get a single socket, reasonably high clock speed, but maybe fewer cores. And then, you know, put 64 gigs of RAM in it or something reasonable and just add some of those so you can grow capacity without necessarily having to incur the full licensing for two sockets if you don't need a lot more compute.
And John, I think this all goes back to customer creativity, right? So vSAN has been in the market now for 3 years. Also from the product team in my career, vSAN has the most transparent and market-facing documentation, blogs, videos that a customer can consume. So I think what we're seeing with this off-road quirky config questions is our customers are smart, and particularly my customers. They're reading all the documentation, and then they're pushing the feature sets to the limits and adapting them because we're a software only, knowing that they could adapt to meet their current business challenges, right? So it's our jobs as SEs and technical leaders to kind of rein them in within the guidelines of supportability. But that creativity on the flip side is also helping us build a better product to meet that market need.
I agree. And one thing was really enlightening when I came to VMware. Previously, you'd hear things are supported, things are not supported. I just always imagined anything that was not supported, someone had tested that and it must, you know, the cluster must physically light on fire or something. And the reality is you learn 80% of it is it'd probably work. Just no one's tested or no one's made a, not tested. And there's not, no one's presented a valid business case for that config. There's not an alternative that we can steer you back on road. Or there is an alternative we can steer you back around. So yeah, you could do that, but how about you just do this instead? It's going to cost you an extra $50. You know, it's the added costs are kind of a joke. Just go do that instead. And people generally nod and smile. And then there's another 10% where it's, yeah, we actually have tested it. We know it lights on fire. You know, it gasoline starts, you know, flaming out of the servers or something. And then there's another 10% of, you know, we never really thought of that. Or, you know, you have a valid business case. We haven't heard that before. And that is something we're engaging, you know, with your SEs who then engage with the product managers. They may go through, you know, an exercise where they sit there and negotiate, they discuss with engineering and GSS and say, is this doable? Will this work? And is this supportable? Because that's another thing. If this is something that the concerns are around, yes, it will work, but there's concerns about supportability or corner cases causing problems, that may be the reason for a no-go.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I really like about, especially being in part of the vSAN team there, there's a cadence of versions that keep coming out. So like, you know, customers put in, you know, I'm sure, James, you probably get a lot of questions or at least requests from customers. And have you seen any of those contributed into, you know, ultimate versions of vSAN?
Absolutely. So if we look back historically, two-node vSAN was actually a customer proposal. Right. We had always proposed that two-node vSAN, given was a very niche market, that we were focusing on the data center and the enterprise. We have a very large customer said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you could replace my single server in a store or in a branch office with a two-node giving me some data redundancy with N plus one? It took off from an idea perspective. And now we have that use case as a go-to-market strategy.
That's awesome.
When, another thing on two-node was the witness traffic separation. So previously, the witness heartbeat was done on the same VM kernel port as vSAN, and you couldn't directly connect. And this required, if you wanted to do 10 gig, you had to buy a 10 gig switch, which most people don't want to do for two hosts, you know, at a small drugstore or something. But this was, there was a valid use case for this. And what's interesting about this one is that feature actually shipped in an earlier version of the code under an RPQ so that some select customers could test it. Under guidance from PM with specific blessing. And that's a case of, you know, a valid config was done. Was it ready to ship at a full scale to where we were supporting, you know, 1,000 customers on it? Not yet, but there is an option under RPQ for a smaller group or one customer who has a strong justification and the code's ready to so to speak, be the, not necessarily the guinea pig, it's still tested, but be, you know, customer one, not customer zero.
Yeah, and John, just to that point on the RPQ, right? The RPQ is it's a special request to engineering and support for these off-road type use cases. If there's enough demand for it, then it becomes a feature or it becomes part of the product. But purposefully, that RPQ process is difficult to achieve and to get approval on, right? Because the last thing that we want to do from a product team and from a company is start building one of Snowflake configs.
So, oh, absolutely. I think 95% of the requests I see are clearly shot down. And it's generally because it goes back to, that's not a real business case. There's something very easy you can do, or no, we know that light's on fire.
Yeah.
We'll put that feature in the, you know, but we are getting that request, so we'll put it on the roadmap or we'll start evaluating it. And that's really where 95% of the, and again, going back to the beginning of this discussion, as you go further and further off road, things get really slow. So I encourage customers, obviously, to try to stay within ready nodes and reference architectures and as well within the lines of those best practices, because it does slow you down when you go off-road.
Right. And we're seeing that trend, John, right? So when I joined this team 3 years ago with vSAN 5.5, if everyone remembers it, I would say 80% of my customers were doing a build-your-own approach with a blade or a server, different memory, different I/O controllers. We're now shifting because that became a risk factor from a supportability. Now I see maybe less than 5% of my customers want to do a build your own, and everyone is adopting the ReadyNode approach or a traditional appliance approach.
Yeah, why not?
Exactly.
Well, it's so easy. You got this one little SKU that you send off to your VAR, and you know, they send off to Disney and say, I want this, and it's going to show up, you know, as intended. Now, one thing to note is, do you see customers who they'll sometimes change the drives or certain things on the ReadyNode or maybe the memory or CPU configuration?
I have. Basically, the way I position with my customers is the ReadyNode becomes a template. There's nothing preventing a customer from tweaking that, working with their OEM and the technical expertise at that OEM vendor. And there's also a blog post, I think, that came out from VMware a couple of weeks ago that goes into what you can and cannot tweak within a ReadyNode. So my advice to my customers is treat the ReadyNode as your baseline architecture, but then within certain guardrails, you could tweak memory, CPU, certain drives, and so on.
Yeah, and there's actually, I'm looking at that post right now. It's done by Bizwa, and it's, my opinion, post of the year on virtual blocks in terms of usefulness for customers who are trying to design things. And it outlines, you know, CPU, memory, caching capacity tier guidance, NICs. People, I've been shocked how many people are, you know, can I add another NIC to this? And yeah, you can add another NIC. And, you know, in terms of changes to the boot device, and it's got links to all the, you know, if you really want to know why these things are there, like for instance, boot devices, what are their endurance requirements and things like that, it links to that raw KV. But as you mentioned earlier, if you're starting with that template and you're changing as few things as possible, it keeps the process fast and simple.
Awesome. Well, I'll be sure to leave that and a couple of your other blog posts on this on the show notes of the page. That's good stuff. Yeah, I think we should probably turn this into a bit of a series, bringing the SEs on, getting some of this field input. This has been a really good episode, in my opinion. So, James, I appreciate you coming on. John, is there anything else that we want to cover on this episode before we take off?
I got nothing.
No, that's it for me. John, enjoy the rest of your vacation.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to go find another fruity drink. So,
for me.
Mojitos awesome. For everybody.
Very cool. All right, well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. Subscribe to us on SoundCloud or iTunes by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this in all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. Next week, we're going to be talking to Mr. Christian Dickman about some of the vSAN operations. Is vSAN radically simple? We'll see.
Profoundly dumbfounded.
Sto Storage is cool.
Enough of this jibber jabber.